Podcast. Today is podcast number 141 for Tuesday, May 8th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and today I'm going to go over a couple things. One of them is fairly recent, and one of them is pretty old. But before I get into that, now, I do want to give one explanation. This is going to sound a little bit mechanical, maybe, because what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be talking about people like Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, Robert Higgs, and Roderick Long, and a little bit of Stefan Molyneux as well. And so I want to be sure and be very careful about the words that I pick. If I'm going to be talking about people of that caliber, I definitely want to be very specific about what I say. So for that reason, I have much of my notes are far more specific than they normally are. So I'll be reading a lot of this and then commenting on what I've read, as opposed to just having some, you know, rough outlines like I usually use, and then just kind of wing it. Now, I want to start off by establishing the difference between a market, well, the market, or markets, and governments, or the government. So again, I apologize if this seems mechanical, but let me get through what I've written here. Markets reward good behavior. If a supplier is successfully providing a good or a service that people want, they reward that supplier by giving him money for his good or service. This not only encourages the supplier to provide more of his product, it encourages other suppliers to enter that market and compete. Because there's money available there, obviously. It's a draw to other suppliers. These two factors drive the quality of the goods or services higher, and they drive the price lower while still rewarding the suppliers. This competition drives innovation as the suppliers reach the lowest possible price they can achieve while still maintaining a profit. Innovation is rewarded by more profits, and both the suppliers' and the consumers' lives are made better by this process. But in seeing this principle, it's just as important to understand that markets punish bad behavior. If a supplier fails to provide a good or service that people want, they punish that supplier by holding back money from him. This encourages other suppliers to step in and provide the goods and services the people are wanting. When this happens, the people reward the new supplier's goods and behavior, and the loop begins again. Governments reward bad behavior. If an arm of government provides an unacceptable good or service, the government addresses that problem by increasing government interference and dumping more money on the problem. So, for example, if schools are failing, the only solution offered by government is more legislation and more money. And if massive worldwide air and military supremacy and intrusive security forces at airports fail to prevent a handful of Saudis and Egyptians from flying planes into buildings, the only solution offered by government are massive expansions of the failed programs, including the dehumanization of the population and a wave of invasions into foreign countries, backed up by spending quantities of money the average legislator can't even comprehend. So, should a person who wants liberty get involved in or try to change government? Okay, now this is inspired by a Facebook discussion that I initiated, and then I just watched it happen. But also, this is kind of inspired by, you know, all of the stereotypical Facebook arguments when you start seeing minarchists and anarchists and libertarians and agorists and volunteer. When all these people start to bump noses, whether it's on Facebook or pretty much anywhere else on the internet, you really quickly, the argument will degenerate into straw man arguments and personal attacks, and or at least they always tend to go that direction. So then, what do we do? Do we look to the intellectuals? Well, maybe. Murray Rothbard spent his life trying to build coalitions with the political parties and trying to draw them towards the cause of liberty. Ron Paul and his success is largely a product of Murray's efforts. But can the top-down process work? No, it can't. Behold the idol that Ron Paul has become. Look at the imagery and see the cult following he has amassed. But whatever you do, don't disagree with his followers. This, my friends, is not a movement towards liberty. So let's look in a different direction. Robert Higgs wrote an article, and you can find it on badquaker.com. I'll put the link to that article on the page where this podcast appears. And the name of it was, What is the Point of My Libertarian Anarchism? By Robert Higgs. Now, Bob takes what may be called the high ground in this article. After much thought and consideration, Bob sees his only moral choice is to remain separate from the mechanisms of aggression and live his life the best he can, avoiding the aggression of government whenever possible. His life becomes an example to follow, even though Bob never becomes an idol to worship or a leader to rally around. In a lecture titled An Anarchist Legal Order by Roderick Long, I'll provide the link again on the page where this podcast appears, Roderick carefully examines two options. One, taking over the government by infiltrating and then dismantling it. This method ultimately requires a majority control of government. And two, bypassing the government through education and alternative institutions, through ignoring it and through encouraging others to withdraw their support of government to the point of mass civil disobedience, and through lack of support, it withers away. The problem with these options is that they both require many more anarchists than exist. Additionally, Roderick attempts to explain and then refute the moral argument against infiltrating government. However, he lacks the depth of understanding on the topic that Robert Higgs possesses, so his argument falls flat to anyone who actually believes in the Higgs-style moral argument. Then he builds an Imperial Stormtrooper straw man. Now, at this point, I'm going to play for you a little excerpt out of Roderick Long's speech, An Anarchist Legal Order. And then I'll get right back with you and we will go over this a little bit.
So here's the idea, that by holding office, I am thereby taking on and agreeing to wield power that, as a libertarian, I'm committed to thinking is unjust. So I'm now wielding unjust power. And that's illegitimate. You know, the worry is not that I'm going to be corrupted by the power. And they certainly have that worry, that I'll be corrupted by the power. But this is a separate point. This is the point is that even if you're not corrupted by the power, even if there aren't sort of bad psychological results for you as a result of wielding the power, it's inherently unjust for you to wield the power because this is unjust power. And it doesn't matter if you're going to do good stuff with it. You shouldn't have it to begin with. Then there's also the argument that voting itself is a form of unjust power. Because when you vote, you're not just voting for yourself, you're voting for other people. Whoever wins the vote, the majority who wins the vote is going to be imposing whatever it is they want on the minority. And so by voting, you are thereby exercising unjust power against, or exercising or attempting to exercise unjust power against the minority. Now, I think these claims are too strong. Think of it this way. You know, suppose that you're infiltrating the Death Star, and so you've got to put You know, you've got to put on Imperial Stormtrooper uniforms in order to get on there. Now, we're not talking here about the worry that in order to prove you're a Stormtrooper, you might have to torture a prisoner or something. That's a different kind of worry. But just the worry that by putting on the uniform of the enemy, you thereby have what? Have you endorsed this unjust system? Or by taking over the Death Star, you're now wielding this illegitimate power, namely the Death Star itself. Well, what counts as wielding it? I mean, you're not aiming it at anyone. You are going into something that's already aimed at people, and you're trying to take it apart. And it doesn't seem to, like, just to suppose that there were, you know, suppose there were a Death Star hovering above the Mises Institute with a beam pointed, you know, down and was, you know, about to fire. And so I managed to get up there and get into the Death Star, and I'm trying to dismantle it. And someone says, oh no, look what Roderick is doing. He's now in the Death Star that's aimed at the Mises Institute. Isn't that unjustified? He is now occupying this unjust position. Well, that seems too strong. Likewise for the voting position. I find the voting position particularly puzzling because the voluntarists, who are the main ones who make this argument, are also big fans of the arguments by people like Herbert Spencer and Lysander Spooner that are designed to prove that we don't consent to government by voting. Because some people have said, by engaging in voting, you're thereby consenting to government, and therefore government is legitimate. And the voluntarists don't like that argument. They agree with arguments by Spooner and Spencer. Spooner says you don't count as consenting to government when you vote because you're really voting as a matter of self-defense. And Spencer says you don't count as consenting to the government when you vote because nothing you do counts as not consenting. If you vote, you're thereby consenting to the system, but if you don't vote, then you say, well, then if you don't vote, you can't complain. So you're thereby again consenting to the system. If nothing you do counts as saying no, then your yes doesn't seem to mean much. Well, I think the voluntarists are right in citing these arguments by Spooner and Spencer. But I think their own argument against voting comes dangerously close to the very arguments that they rightly reject. It comes close to saying that by exercising the vote, you are somehow sanctioning state power. Because when you vote, you are, you know, you're trying to impose what you're voting on everyone. All right, fine. But what are you voting for? You know, if you're voting for an increase in liberty, then it's not clear how it is you're imposing anything on anybody.
All right. Now, at this point, I should make a disclaimer here. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Roderick Long. I have learned a ton of stuff from Roderick Long. I enjoy listening to his weird little voice. I don't mean that as a jab. Everyone is stuck with the voice that they're given, but his voice. I once said his voice is like fine wine; it has to grow on you. But I really enjoy hearing him speak, and I've learned a ton from Roderick Long. And I could say the same thing about Robert Higgs. I've actually, you know, spoke with Bob Higgs in person. He's a wonderful person. And so anything that I say that contradicts something that they say, it's not because I'm attacking them as individuals or their intellectual capability, because quite obviously they both are in a league far above me in intellectual capabilities. So I just want to give that little disclaimer that I'm not saying anything against the character or against the intellect of either Roderick Long or Robert Higgs in saying this. Now, having said that, this Death Star argument really fails and is a horrible straw man. I don't know of anyone who believes that just going to Washington, D.C., dressing in a three-piece suit, and working on disrupting government would be considered as aggression. Now, that's basically what he describes in his invading the Death Star. You climb up there, you put on the uniform, and you go and you try to dismantle the thing. Well, if you go to Washington, D.C., throw on a three-piece suit, and start trying to disrupt or dismantle government, I don't know of anybody who would call that aggression, as long as you don't actually aggress on someone. Although I will mention that Jeffrey Tucker has done a couple of articles on how this weird influence that takes place on a person when they get into the Beltway in Washington, D.C., and they start living the daily life of going to these free lunches and going to all these different activities that are involved in living and functioning in Washington, D.C. But I'll let Jeffrey Tucker make that argument. I'll just say that that Roderick Long's Death Star argument falls short and is definitely a straw man, because nobody's saying that just to dress up and, you know, get involved, just to walk around in Washington, D.C. and try to disrupt it is aggression. What is aggression in government is when you actually take office. And when, once you take office and you take the oath that goes with that office, it's either, according to your position, you are either a legislator or you're in a governing position, in the presidency, the vice presidency, or you're in the judicial end of it, or you're in the legislative end of it. If you're a functioning part of that and you've taken the oath of office and you're actually in there, you're not just walking around dressed up like all the others. You're functionally a part of that government, and you have a certain amount of power that goes with the seated position that you're in. Once in office, you are wielding the power of the Death Star, to use Roderick Long's example. Now, that is not to say you're killing people. There's a vast difference between, you know, everything the government does is not killing people. Everything, so it's illegitimate to even compare it to the Death Star, because the Death Star, of course, was for the purpose of destroying a planet or a whole star system or whatever. But if you get back to reality and kind of look at, you know, what we're talking about with government, what you actually see is that any time that you've taken that oath of office, and this is strictly with the U.S. as far as the oath of office, different countries have different ranks of order, but what we're talking about here specifically is Washington, D.C. So you go to Washington, D.C., you become a congressman or you become the president or whatever. You take that oath of office. Well, what is that? You're swearing to uphold the Constitution, all right? Let's just go back and talk about the Constitution. The preamble to the Constitution, which states the purpose of the Constitution, whether you believe that it's functional or not, is not the point. If you're swearing an oath to it, then there's a moral question that immediately comes up. So the preamble of the Constitution, off the top of my head. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. Really? How are you going to do that without aggression? How are you going to establish top-down justice from a governmental position without aggression? Now, we're not talking about a voluntary society where justice can be established through the processes that Murray Rothbard or Stefan Molyneux or any of the others have gone over and over and over explaining how these things would be done in a voluntary society. We're talking about government. If you swore an oath of office, if you swore your oath of office, you swore to the Constitution to uphold and defend the Constitution, well, that's the beginning of the Constitution. It says, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. How are you going to do those things without the aggression of government? Because every single one of those things is an act of aggression. You have to use aggression to pay for those, to pay for judges, to pay for police, to pay for all these things. If we're not in a voluntary society, then each of those things the Constitution promises requires an act of aggression. And if we're in a voluntary society, then, you know what? We don't need the government. We've got all the layers of organizations that Murray and that Stefan talk about to provide those things without the aggression of government. So this is, it's a self-contradicting point. If you are in office, and if you swear an oath to uphold the Constitution and defend the Constitution, then any act you do as a legislator or in any kind of governing or judicial position, you are doing that as an act of aggression. We're not talking about just dressing up like a stormtrooper and walking around on the Death Star. We are talking about wielding its power. And that's what happens when you're in office. So for that reason, that is why Roderick Long's moral argument And his argument about holding office and his argument about being involved in politics and trying to use the aggression of government to fix what's going on with government, that argument falls flat and does not address Robert Higgs's moral objection to being involved in using government. Okay, now, the second part, his, and I'm back to reading my notes here, is his explanation of the moral objections to voting seems muddled and misses the point. He talks about voting to increase liberty. Now, what does that mean? How do you vote to increase liberty? Is that like voting for a longer leash for your dog, or is it like voting for a bigger cage for your captive bird? I've talked about those things before. You know, a bird in a bigger cage is not a free bird. A bird on a dog on a leash is not a free dog. You can take a bird and convince it that it's free because the cage is so big that it doesn't notice the cage, but it's still not free. So how do you vote for more liberty or less liberty? Now, Roderick fails to address that every act of government is aggression, and voting for a person to be in government and voting that that person acts on your behalf is essentially the same as you doing the aggression. So in other words, if you believe what I just cut through saying a second ago about how every act that the legislator or that the person, you know, governor or president or whatever, or the person in the judiciary branch, every act they do is an act of aggression because everything they do is wielding power. If you believe that, if you understand the concept there, that they can't do anything, the government can't do anything without that threat of aggression. Everything that it does, is it gonna send money to this cause? Well, it had to steal it from somebody else. Or I've used this argument before, the very microphones that they speak into on the House floor are paid for and powered by stolen money. The lights that illuminate the things that they read on the House floor, those lights are powered by stolen money. When they print out copies of things and distribute it among each other, they are stealing money to print those copies out and distribute it to each other. When they catch a ride back to wherever that it is that they live or where they're staying, and they put that into their congressional budget for their office, they're stealing from somebody to pay for that. Every single act they do, once in government, once actually a part of it. So back to Roderick's Death Star thing, we're not just talking about putting on the uniform. We're talking about swearing the oath of allegiance and actually becoming part of the hordes. That's what we're talking about here. Once they do that, every act that they do is an act of aggression, and it's paid for by theft. So then, when you vote for them, no matter who you're, you know, no matter what the intent is or good or bad or anything else, if you're voting for somebody else to act on your behalf in government, then you're simply asking someone to aggress on your behalf. It's exactly the same as if you yourself were aggressing. Now, I want to refer to this concept that you're trying to increase liberty. If you vote for somebody and they're going to try to go up and increase your liberty, let's just think about Bastiat for a moment. Bastiat went to a lot of effort to show that every single act of government has two sets of consequences: the one that is seen and the one that is not seen. And whenever that which is seen appears to be good, the odds are that which is not seen is going to be bad. So what Bastiat really put a lot of effort into explaining, and I know Roderick Long and I know Bob Higgs are both very familiar with Bastiat's writings. So what Bastiat put a lot of effort into saying was, it doesn't matter what the intent is. Once government starts doing it, there are consequences of that action that you can't predict, that are far and beyond the scope of your vision of what you're seeing when you actually make those acts. So when government acts, there's always something that is unpredictable that's going to cause a negative effect. Now, I want to go back to something that I refer to regularly. Let's think of the highwayman. The highwayman is out there on the highway, and he's robbing a coach. And you know, he forces the coach to stop, and everybody in the coach gets out, and he robs everybody in the coach. He takes their money, and he rides away into the night. Well, then, you know, after a while, he shows up at his pub that he likes to go to, and the bartender at the pub has no idea where the money comes from. I mean, he's just a bartender, and this guy is just a guy who comes in now and then. And so the guy comes in, he spends a lot of money, he drinks a lot, he tips the waitress good, and he leaves. Now, the bartender looks at this, and he says, hey, this guy's a good guy. He comes in regularly, he tips well. Because of him, you know, my waitress has a better attitude and works harder. Because of this guy, I can afford shoes for my children. He's a good guy. What he's doing is good. That's because the bartender is only seeing one aspect of what's being done. He's not seeing the robbery. And so when we look to government to do good things for us, even so-called, you know, increasing our liberty, how are you going to do that? How can government give you liberty? Does it have a bucket of liberty somewhere to hand out to you? Now, one argument might be to go in this direction. You say, well, what about if the government simply repeals laws? So, for instance, let's say the one of the big arguments is the legalizing marijuana argument. Let's say, just for the sake of argument, that you're voting for somebody to go into government, and the whole purpose that they're going to go in there is to try to get rid of the marijuana laws. Well, first off, let me just say this about the marijuana laws. And of course, I don't use anything like that. I don't recommend anyone use anything like that. On the other hand, the problem is not that it's a plant that some people want and some people don't want them to have it. That's you know, the issue is not that you want this particular plant, or you want it so that you can get high, or you want it so that you can relieve the pain of your illness that you have, or you want it for... That's not the point. The point is, the idea that government can tell a person what plants they can possess or what plants they can buy and sell and trade, that's the problem. Well, I don't really know of anybody in government who's really talking about that in a serious way, saying, look, this is a property rights issue. It's not about whether or not, you know, this needs to be, you know, to help the sick people or whatever, or we can tax it and regulate it. We can make sure that, or this is going to help with our budget. These are the arguments that people throw around. And all that is just more aggression. The fact is that when you're talking about a plant, any plant, or any object, anything, knife, gun, bazooka, anything, if one person or a group of people can tell you you can or can't own it, or regulate aspects of whether you're owning it, then they're your masters. They own you. They're controlling your behavior. You don't actually own anything. If they can tell you what you can and can't own, then you don't actually own anything. So you know, is there a short-term good to getting someone into a position in legislature where they can make our lives easier? Sure. Yeah, that's great. If my master is beating me four times a week and I can shine his shoes once in a while and that'll make him only beat me twice a week, then shining his shoes would be a good idea. But you can't confuse that with the fact that you're a slave and he's beating you. You can't at any point step back and say, well, all right, if he just beats me less and less, maybe someday he won't beat me at all, and then, you know, I'll be okay as a slave. You can't go in that. You first, you know, okay, look at it this way. Let's say you're out on a rifle range, and you set up your target, and you set up your rifle, and you have a bench there. You're going to very comfortably sit at the bench and shoot at your target. And you take a shot out there at your target, and you realize that your sights are way off, and you hit like 10 yards short of your target. Well, what you're not gonna do is just keep shooting 10 yards short and say, well, you know, at least it's only 10 yards short. At least it's not 30 yards short. No, what you're going to do is you're going to adjust your aim, and you're going to keep adjusting your aim until you hit the target, because the target is what you want. Anything short of the target is failure. Anything short of freedom is failure. So, yeah, if you can, you know, if you can get the master to beat you 3 times a week instead of 6 times a week, well, great, shine his shoes. But never let it escape your mind that this is a slavery situation and it's immoral. So when we're dealing with government, yeah, it, you know, on a temporary basis, if we can get the government to back off of us a little bit and make our lives a little bit better, then for us right now on a temporary basis, then there's a pragmatic argument to say, well, at least life will be a little bit better. But what you're actually doing is you're making government more comfortable for people so that they're less likely to object to it. And in the long run, for future generations, that's a bad thing to do to people. That's a horrible thing to do to your children. To make government, to make slavery a little bit more comfortable now so that, you know, we can tolerate it. That's morally, that's bad. I don't like that. Okay, I'm going to break for a commercial. I'm going to be back in 2 minutes, and we'll keep going with this. Thanks a lot, folks. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Now, I want to give a little bit of a recap what I was talking about. Making government tolerable and putting off the struggle for freedom was the idea that was the last concept that I was talking about there right before the commercial break. So putting off... Putting as government becomes more and more totalitarian, and we see more and more government reveals itself for what it really is, more people, their eyes are open to this. A lot of people accredit Ron Paul with the explosion in libertarian and anarchist and anarcho-capitalist thought in the last few years. And Ron Paul deserves a lot of that credit. But there's something that people are in their worship of Ron Paul, and I realize I'm going to... that's the second time in this podcast I've brought this up, but the fanatical of the following of Ron Paul is really kind of getting weird. So if you break your mind away from that for a minute and just step back and ask yourself, is it possible that there's another factor beyond or beside Ron Paul, which is also causing people to seek liberty and to look around? Well, think about it a little bit. all those people in the Tea Party movement that didn't even know about Ron Paul. And now I realize, calm down, Ron Paul folks, I realize that Ron Paul started the Tea Party movement. But a lot of those people that came rushing into the Tea Party movement knew nothing about Ron Paul and didn't even know he started it. And yet they saw something that they needed to get involved with. They saw something wrong. And so what I'm trying to say here is, if you just set aside the Ron Paul factor and you look at the world, look at the U.S., but look at the world and look at what's been going on for, you know, dramatically increasing in the last 10 to 15 years, specifically since, you know, September 11th, 2001, government oppression has just exploded. And you can't have that happen and not have a reaction to it among people. So if you just take the Ron Paul factor and set it aside, I'm not discrediting Ron Paul. I'm not saying people were not drawn to the Liberty Movement by him. But if you just take whatever influence he may have had and just set it to the side for a moment, and you realize that when the TSA, when there's video after video after video of the TSA groping and molesting old women and crippled people, crippled veterans, little children, when you see story after story of where someone has to, you know, just face horrible things at the hands of the TSA just to try to get from one location to the other, and they have to tolerate this from the government. And we see the video on YouTube and in other places. And when we see the dramatic increase in the police state to where just folks driving down the road doing absolutely nothing wrong and they get pulled over, like this guy coming back from the Star Trek convention, coming from St. Louis to Cincinnati, spends the better part of a day in the dead of winter standing on the side of the freeway in Illinois while some goon ruffles through everything he owns and threatens him. This kind of thing is increasing more and more and more. And you can't have tyranny increase like that without having repercussions for it. And the repercussion is that people begin to desire liberty. Now, back to the Ron Paul factor. Having Ron Paul is a wonderful thing for all of us because it gives a voice where people can look and say, oh, wait, this crazy old man is not so crazy. He kind of makes some sense. So I'm not saying Ron Paul is not a factor in this, but what I'm saying is the dramatic increase in tyranny in the last 15 years, and even going back prior to that, this started going, you know, well, it started in 1789 or whatever it was, but it's dramatically increased in the last 20, 30 years, and then just got out of control since September 11th, 2001. And this increase in tyranny cannot take place without an equal increase in the desire for liberty. So it's actually tyranny that drives a person to want liberty. I've used this example before. You know, people walk around day to day and they don't think about air. They don't think about breathing. They walk around day after day after day, never thinking about air. You know, it's all around us. It's in abundance. But you reach up and grab somebody by the throat, and everything in the world then revolves around air. The only thing that matters to that person is air. And liberty is like that. When you start to strangle a people, prior to strangling, you let people walk around. They don't realize the liberty they're walking around in. People who are free never think about their freedom. They just walk around and just enjoy life, and they just do the stuff that they do. They don't think about it. They don't think about liberty until that hand reaches up and starts to strangle them. Then, when there's a scarcity of liberty, then they begin to recognize the value of it. It's like any other commodity. If there's unlimited quantity, then it has no value. It's only when you begin to strangle its supply that the value starts to drive up, and it becomes more and more important by the second. So Ron Paul has had a dramatic influence in the Liberty Movement. But honestly, folks, there would be no significant liberty movement right now today if it weren't for the tyranny that's driving it. It's the tyranny that's driving it, not Ron Paul. Ron Paul's just a man. Stop bowing before him. Stop acting the way the Obama supporters act when Obama walks in the room. Lots of us, made fun of horribly mocked, the followers of Obama in 2008 as they just fell on the ground in worship of him. And young women would, it was like the Beatles were coming into town or something when Obama would have these conventions. Well, now, what are we seeing with Ron Paul? We're seeing the same thing that we saw in 2008 with Obama, where people are putting all their hopes and dreams in a man, in a human being. Folks, I like Ron Paul, but he's just a man. He is not the liberty movement, and he is not your savior. He will not bring you liberty. Okay, now, so back to what off the Ron Paul rant, and let's get back to what I'm actually trying to say here. So when you crank back government and you take some of the little, you know, well, I talked the other day on a podcast about the government giving pacifiers. Yeah, okay, yeah, so, you know, we're increasing our surveillance, we're increasing the drones, we're increasing how many emails we're listening, we're reading, we're increasing how much phone conversations we're listening to. Oh, but we're going to give you the castle doctrine in 3 more states. Hippie hooray. Whoopee. I just want to dance with joy because a watered-down version of the castle doctrine is now available in 3 more states. I can't travel from one place to the other without being stopped by the TSA's Cobra squads. They're going to just randomly stop me on the highways to see what I'm up to. That's fine. I'll overlook that. Because, you know, Minnesota or whatever's got the castle doctrine now. The government offers you these little pacifiers, little morsels off the master's table to keep you happy. But in fact, they are constantly ratcheting up government every time there's a little bit of a crisis. And if they don't have a crisis, they'll make a crisis. So what happens if everybody, all the people in the marijuana movement, they all get their way, and more states legalize medical marijuana, and let's just say, you know, a fantasy world where Ron Paul actually gets elected, and he goes in and he cuts back the DEA, and he cuts back all these programs, and so the federal government's not interfering with the states on the marijuana laws. Well, then you've suddenly made government more palatable, haven't you? But it's just as powerful as it was. Let's pick on Mike Tyson for a minute. Now, Mike Tyson is a bit of a goon. He's a thug, and he's not that bright. But he's an unbelievably powerful human being. Now, you put that man in the ring, and he's like a monster, especially when he was young and in his prime. He's a fighting machine. Okay, but now you take him out of the ring, and you put a nice suit on him, and you set him down at a table in a fine restaurant, and you try to convince him to use a fork and knife like a human. And he is just as dangerous sitting at a table with a steak in front of him and a fork and a knife talking about philosophy as he is in that ring. He doesn't lose any of his power by cleaning him up and putting him in a different location and dressing him up. Well, government is like this. It's like it's the genie out of the bottle syndrome. Once you have accepted the idea of the state, I've talked about this so many times. I hate to bring it up on every podcast. This difference between the government and the state, the government being the actual people that go and do stuff, and the buildings and the physical stuff that we see are representations of the government. But the state is a concept in our mind where we say this government is legitimate as it uses aggression to enforce its will upon us. That belief is the state. The practical outworking of people and buildings and tanks and airplanes, all that stuff is the government. But the concept, the myth, that that stuff is legitimate. That's the state. Okay, so I have to throw that out every time because I walk myself into it every time. But anyway, once you grasp the concept of the state and you accept that myth as being real, you've let the genie out of the bottle. And you can't cram it back in, and you can't make it shrink. It's always going to grow more and more and more powerful. And it's always going to seek to consume more and more and more of its host. And so, yeah, for a short time, for a temporary basis, we get our Ron Paul in or whatever. We get the, even if it's not Ron Paul, we get our favorite people into government and we get them elected and they, you know, give us a few morsels off the table and they stop beating us six times a week and now they're only beating us three times a week. Yet, we still have the drones, we still have the, and even if they don't actually fly them, they have the capability, they've set the precedent, and that bar has already been established. And so they might back down from it in their practical day-to-day routines, but they never back down from the power that they have. They might relinquish some activities, but they will never relinquish the power. The government never does. It never voluntarily pulls itself backwards like that. So then, let me see if I can recap this just a little bit before I run out of time. In this statement here that Roderick Long makes, he fails completely to address the moral argument that's expressed by Bob Higgs. And both Bob Higgs and Roderick Long fall short explaining how the state can continue. You know, I don't know. Did I actually make Bob Higgs's argument? Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did early on in the thing where I said that he takes the moral high ground, but he doesn't see how we can ever get to a point of where we're not going to have the state, because in his words, the state is very successful at what it really does. It really doesn't serve us. Really, what it does is serve itself. And it's very efficient at that, at consuming more and more and growing bigger and bigger. It's always done that, always will do that. But what Bob falls short on here is, from an economic point of view, he doesn't explain, and neither does Roderick Long, how the government, but in the bigger picture, the state, worldwide, can continue to grow and consume its host indefinitely. At some point, there has to be an end to this. At some point, it has to consume enough of its host that the host can no longer support it. Now, we see this coming to a certain extent with the U.S., and I think maybe many economists and many libertarians and maybe even many anarcho-capitalists, and I think maybe Bob Higgs and Roderick Long might be looking at the U.S. as sort of the as the main point that they're thinking of. But, you know, whether the U.S. stands or falls is not the state's going to go on one way or the other without the U.S. And the state's going to continue to grow until it consumes everything that it can. I mean, that's just the logical end of it if you think it through. So at some point, the state will reach a saturation point where it can't grow any further. And since its very existence requires that it continues to grow and consume more, when it gets to a certain point, something has to give. Now, as it grows more and more oppressive, and the tyranny aspect of government becomes more and more obvious. So this increase in tyranny, just like we saw in the last 15 years or so, causes a directly equal proportion of an increase in the desire for liberty. The more tyranny there is, the greater the desire for liberty. So if you make the tyranny more palatable, all you're really doing is dulling the desire for liberty, and you're just pushing it off to your children's generation. I don't want to do that. You know, I'm there. It's the old thing of do you ease into the pool or do you jump in? I've always been a jump in kind of a person. I don't want to ease in. Let's get this done. It's the Band-Aid thing. Do you carefully work the Band-Aid? Well, I'm a hairy person. I'm very hairy. And yet, when it comes time to get the Band-Aid off, I tear that thing off. I'd rather just get it done. Face whatever it is that I've got to face and let's get on with it. This incremental stuff doesn't work for me. And as a matter of fact, I played recording on the podcast some time ago. I should have gotten that today and played it today since I'm playing these others. But where Ron Paul himself says that it's impossible to achieve liberty incrementally. He said that himself on one of his weekly podcasts that he does from his phone. It's impossible to achieve liberty incrementally. It can't be done. It's never, ever been done in the past. But it can't be done as you logically pursue the topic, which I don't have time to do today because I'm very rapidly running out of time here. Okay, so back to my notes. I say here in my notes that I was referring to the United States government as simply being one tentacle of this larger beast. And also I would make the point that as the state grows, as it logically must, it reveals more and more of its true nature. And the more of its nature is revealed, the less people will believe the myth of the benevolent state. See, that's what keeps the state alive, is that so many people think, well, yeah, but if it wasn't for the state, but the state provides this, but the state provides that. The state doesn't provide you with anything. I went over that before. The state only gets in the way of giving you stuff. This was in the very beginning of this when I was talking about how markets reward good behavior, but governments reward bad behavior. Governments don't bring you anything. Governments simply get in the way of the market bringing you things. So when it appears as though the government is giving you something, first off, the government can't give you something without stealing it from somebody else. But things like, well, we have the roads, or we have mail service, or we have, you know, we have security, or we have the judicial system, or we have, you know, whatever it is that you imagine that the government is giving to you, it's not really. The market is giving you those things. The government is simply regulating and getting in the way and burdening it with taxes and with hoops to have to jump through. So the government doesn't give you anything at all. And as this monster grows, its benevolence, the myth of its benevolence, will get thinner and thinner, and it'll be harder and harder to justify why we have this leech sucking on our veins. Okay, so this process that I'm describing, in conjunction with what Stefan Molyneux talks about, and that is where we win the future. Stefan Molyneux talks about winning the future, that it lies in right in raising new generations of little anarchists. As you raise generations of kids without violence, without teaching them that violence and aggression are natural parts of life, as you raise kids into that environment, then they're shocked when they see aggression and they can spot it as being not right. Rather than the current situation we have where generations are raised in violent homes and shoved into violent schools and pushed around by violent government, and the whole time they're taught, well, these aggressions, that's how it's supposed to be. And this opposite thing that's taught to kids where you say, you know, don't hit, don't aggress on other kids, and yet everything that society tells us is aggression is good because society's run on aggression. So this is Stefan Molyneux's argument. So as we teach a new generation of little kids that you can have society without this aggression, then aggression becomes odd to them. So these two things in conjunction, as the state grows and becomes more oppressive, and as the myth of the benevolent state gets thinner and thinner and harder to support, and as we raise a generation after generation of little anarchists that grow up realizing, seeing the state for what it is, not waiting till they're 20 or 30 or 50 to see the state in its real light, but those kids will begin to see the state for what it's like when they're four, when they're six, maybe even when they're two. But as soon as they start getting a grasp of the world around them, and they start to see what society is like when it's under the control of the state, those kids are going to have a huge impact on the liberty movement in the future. And as more and more people begin to see the state for what it's like, and another generation of kids are raised up and become adults and know this stuff from their youth, we're talking about an unstoppable force. But the state will have to grow, and the state will have to get nastier and nastier and nastier. So then, let's take this back to what Roderick Long mentioned. Eventually, what I'm describing here, as the state grows and as the state gets more oppressive, and as generations of, you know, Stefan Molyneux's little anarchists, as they start growing up, what we actually have is a majority that's an anarchist majority that's being developed. And this is exactly what Roderick Long said. If you have, oh, I didn't play that part. You know, I should play that part. Hold on, I'll play that part. Hold on.
Still, I think it's certainly true that we shouldn't think of libertarianism as something that can be sort of socially engineered from the top down. It's certainly right for them to have that concern. And more specifically, they say, well, look, if the majority of people are already converted to libertarianism, then you don't need to get people in political power and start imposing things. If the majority of people are already libertarian, then they can just go ignore the state. And if they all ignore the state would go away. Just a few people ignore the state, it doesn't go away. But if most people ignore the state, then they're just some guys without any power. On the other hand, if the majority are not libertarian, then you're not going to succeed in getting into power. Or if you do get into power, you'll quickly be booted out as soon as they realize how radical you are. And so imposing liberty from above won't work if libertarians are not the majority, and it's not necessary if they are. Again, I think that's largely right. It relies on the insight of people like Étienne de la Boétie, who argued that every government necessarily rests on consent in the sense that the rulers are vastly outnumbered by the ruled. There's no way that a few hundred or thousand people in the government could possibly be ordering millions of people what to do unless the millions of people decided to go along with it. Now, his point was you don't need violent revolution. You don't need to force them to do something different. You just start ignoring them. If everyone started ignoring the rulers, then the rulers would just be some guy. However, I think that there are... I don't think that any of this is a decisive argument against political engagement. I do think it's a reason for thinking that the main focus should be on building alternative institutions and educating and so forth. But I don't think it rules out political action entirely. For one thing, you know, suppose that this alternative strategy works and gradually the state starts losing power. Well, if the state starts losing power, the odds are at some point they're going to panic. And when people in power who are about to lose power panic, they might do something nasty, and they might still have, you know, access to weapons of mass destruction, because whether there were any in Iraq or not, there certainly are in the U.S. Or in many other countries where this strategy might be tried.
Okay, so Roderick's point in that was that, of course, just to recap what he just said, if we can't legislate top-down to bring the libertarian utopia into the world. Unless we're a majority. If we're a majority, then we can get control of the government and make it do whatever we want. On the other hand, if we're a majority, we don't need to get control of the government. We can just ignore it and it goes away. So then, if we're not a majority and we get control of the government, everybody else is going to figure out how radical we are, and they're going to kick us out of government. So the idea of getting somebody in control of government top-down is illogical. So then there's the possibility of bottom-up, the grassroots method. Try to get the master to stop beating us five times a week and get it down to three times a week on a local level. Now there's a pragmatic or practical certain amount of logic to that. But that doesn't address Robert Higgs's moral question. Robert Higgs's moral question, according to, you know, where you are as far as your own dedication to morals, is not addressed in that. He takes the high road on it, and I would stand with Robert Higgs on that. In the long run, I think it's better to take the beating and let everyone see how hideous the master is, and then point it out and let us grow until the point of where we don't take over because we have the votes. We take over because we just don't care about them anymore, and we're doing what we're doing, and we have all the organization that we need to do everything that we're going to do. And then, you know, and then there is that thrashing out that Roderick Long mentioned. Well, I talk about that pretty regularly. The state will thrash, just like an angry bear, or like a dying lion, or a dying dragon in its last few minutes. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you.